circle of White Light Radio. Focusing on solutions and thinking different.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to Circle of White Light Radio with myself, Alan James. It's the 19th of March, 2023. Good evening and hello to everyone logging into the chat room there. My guests on the show tonight are two ladies, one called Gloria Moss and the other one is called Catherine Armitage. And basically, we're going to be talking about critical thinking. I'd also like to say, I hope everybody had a great St. Patrick's Day last Friday. Some people celebrate it, other people don't celebrate it. They have their opinion on St. Patrick. And of course, on a typical St. Patrick's Day, it was raining, which is no surprise there because it generally does rain on St. Patrick's Day for some reason. Most years it's always raining. So happy St. Patrick's Day for Friday. Right, let's get on and find out what the communication channels are.
The communication channels are email. Contact us at circleofwhitelight.com, by phone 046-927-1212, or sign up to our newsletter via our website at circleofwhitelight.com.
Okay, folks, you know the website, circleofwhitelight.com. Also on patreon.com/COWLR. And if you want to be notified of anything going on, newsletters and everything else, if you go to the website and type in your email address and subscribe, you'll be notified there. Also, on Rumble, obviously, if you go over to the Rumble channel, you'll see I'm putting up a lot more videos now and loads of things on the Rumble channel. So check it out and see what you think. And as you can probably tell, I still have my cough. It's still there. It's going slowly but surely. I am taking a colloidal silver for that, and it's getting there, but it's just taking its time to go, basically. But I'll keep on taking the colloidal silver anyway. Obviously, t-shirts are available. Give me a shout on email. Contact us at circleofwhitelight.com, and they're 10 euros plus the postage and packing. Okay, so as usual, I have a couple of things to read out first. In the Irish Examiner, it's an Irish newspaper over here, it says people forced to choose between heat or eat as government policies fail, report warns. The government is failing to address the root causes of energy poverty and deprivation, with many Irish households left out in the cold, a new report has warned. The research from Friends of the Earth makes a series of damning findings and says state policy is found wanting in many areas, including in retrofitting and the one-off electricity credit. Based on input from 32 experts across housing, poverty, climate and energy, it argues vulnerable and lower income households are being failed the most by government policies. For frontline services, people presented with now impossible bills and spoke of cutting out food as to pay for their fuel, the report said. Energy spending displaced food spending as the top household outgoing, forcing a choice of heat or eat. People went to bed early to keep warm. Increasing energy costs were creating really desperate situations for vulnerable households. It is really getting bad out there, folks. It's sad to see. And everybody's feeling the pinch with the energy bills and everything happening. And government are not doing anything at all about it. They're just controlled by the WEF, as we all know. The other thing that I've seen during the week, and I'm sure you guys have seen it too, an MP in the Houses of Parliament in the UK, Andrew Bridgen, MP. I've mentioned Andrew before. He's one of a handful of people saying something. He spoke up in Parliament the other day, and you could count the number of MPs in the chambers during his speech on one hand. This gives you an idea how much these MPs give a damn about the people. They also had some clowns saying that the vaccines are safe and saved thousands of people. In response to Andrew, do they seriously believe that they actually believe this rubbish that they're talking about with all the evidence that's out there now? With highly qualified doctors and consultants coming out now exposing what was going on. I just can't believe it. And to be honest with you, if that happened in their own political chambers over here in the Dáil, I'm sure the same thing would have happened. They'd all walk out and just leave one or two people talking about it. I know one or two TDs like Matthew McGrath have raised issues in the Dáil over here. And of course, you know, they were just, you know, attacked really for doing that. So it's just kind of madness. And obviously, the amount of people coming into the country now at the moment, I seen a meme during the week. It said on the meme, a man fleeing war takes his wife and children. A man going to war leaves them behind. So we must be in a war. And that's down to your own interpretation. I don't know how people feel about that. But are we going to war? Is it going that way? I don't know. But it's just that there's certain men of military age over in the country, as we've all talked about before. Okay, I'm going to bring my guests on. My first guest is Gloria Moss. After degrees in French and medieval studies, Gloria studied organization psychology at the LSE and worked in industry as a training and development manager in blue chip companies, and then as a professor in universities. There she researched biological sex differences. Yes, whatever they tell you, they are real. Best practice leadership and optimizing teamwork. Writing 8 books and 8 peer-reviewed journals and conference papers. Her latest book, Lightbulb Moments and the Power of Critical Thinking, written with Catherine Armitage, shows the power of questioning in ascertaining the truth. This can be brought from info@protonmail.com. People can put their questioning skills into practice at the 2 conferences she organises each year. Firstly, Questioning Science in the Peak District on the 16th to 20th of August, and then Questioning History on the 15th and 17th of December near Maidenhead. Details are available from learningholidays@protonmail.com. And Catherine Armitage, who's my other guest, well, I have Gloria and Catherine on together, is a writer, a yoga teacher and homeopath practitioner. She taught homeopathy for Lakeland College of Homeopathy and Detox Retreats at Cranley House. That's cranleyhousehealing.co.uk. She is now devoting her energy to activism to create a better world through campaigning to stop the rollout of 5G, writing and broadcasting Brighter Times magazine, brightertimes.world. Good evening, ladies. How are you doing?
Good evening, Alan. It's a great pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you, Gloria. And Catherine, are you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here, Alan.
Great.
Lovely to be here and good to hear you talking about St. Patrick's Day, which is actually my partner's birthday, so we celebrate that.
Fantastic. Well, you know, people are kind of on the fence with St. Patrick because he wasn't even Irish. And the whole idea of him getting rid of the snakes, well, you know, he never got rid of them. They just went into government. But that's a different story altogether. So listen, ladies, thank you for coming on. The reason what got me very interested in this subject matter, I seen the interview you did with Richard Vobes, and Richard's been on the show and I've been on his show. And critical thinking is very important. What triggered me was the whole idea of what happened during the COVID incident when the SAGE, the nudge groups that the government used, it was SAGE in the UK and it was NEFID over here. And I've mentioned before about the psychology of critical thinking, the whole idea of the prefrontal cortex and the fact that with all the fear that they pushed out, the media and the politicians pushed out, it kind of shut down people's prefrontal cortex. And they just couldn't think because they were inundated with this fear. So they were in kind of flight and flight mode. And brilliant psychology, you know, and my hat's off to them for what they did. And this is what got me thinking when you start talking about it with Richard, about critical thinking. And so I think probably that's the best way to approach it, is to start off there. And let's look at the psychology of what went on. And then we'll get into the psychology of the critical thinking, because to critically think, you have to be, to me, I think you have to be self-aware, you know, to actually do something like that. So, and I want to get into the psychology of critical thinking, but Gloria, I'll go over to you first. How did you see the rollout of COVID and the fact that they were using the SAGE group and the psychology to pump out the fear on the TV and the radio 24/7 to get people to go and get vaccinated. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts, and it's a really interesting question, is that the use of fear by governments has a long history. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book, if you like. And in the 18th century, Burke, who wrote extensively about the French Revolution, this is what he said. No passion, he said, so effectively robs the mind of all of its powers of acting and reasoning as fear. So he said that in the 18th century. And the second president of the United States, John Adams, he really echoed what Burke said. He said, fear is the foundation of most governments and renders men stupid. Mm. So we've known since time immemorial that fear is something that governments might favour because it shuts down critical thinking. But it wasn't actually, I think, until 2016 that we actually discovered the scientific process behind the reason why fear is favoured by government as a technique to use against its populations. And it was in 2016 that research was carried out at Pittsburgh University on the effects of anxiety and fear. And this is really the great reveal and a very fascinating one too, because what this research at Pittsburgh University revealed really makes sense of what Burke said and also John Adams, the second president of the United States. Because what the Pittsburgh research found was that anxiety and fear disrupt the brain neurons in the prefrontal cortex. Fear starts in the amygdala, and then it moves to the prefrontal cortex, and fear shuts down the workings of the prefrontal cortex. So I would say, by way of response, that, yeah, many governments around the world were using the trick of fear against their populations. As I say, it's been used and recognised way back for centuries, and it shuts down critical thinking.
Yeah, which is exactly what it did, and it got the chosen effect that the government wanted to do, all governments wanted to do with the fear. Catherine, what's your thoughts on that, about what happened with COVID and the fact that they used this technique on the population?
Yes, absolutely. And what I noticed, one of my friends is a guy called David Sharalambos, and I went on a trip to visit UK Column, and Brian Gerrish, while we were there, alerted me to one of the Behavioural Insight team's document, the Mind Space document, which I'm sure you will have seen with your interest in psychology, and all the various different ways that the government were using to shut us down, using authority figures to give out pithy little phrases, you know, stay safe, vaccines are safe and effective. There were all sorts of things, weren't there, that they used.
Yeah.
And once David Sharalambos did a reaching people Zoom, in fact, he still does it every week, combines, there's also one with emotional freedom technique, and he went through this document bit by bit, and it's like anything, once you can see the workings of these psychological techniques playing out, and it's like exposing, it's like lifting the curtain, isn't it, in Yellow Brick Road at the end.
Yeah.
you see the shadows being exposed for what they are, and then it loses its power, and then that chain reaction, which is when the amygdala is overworked, everything can then settle down and the prefrontal cortex can start to get a sense of reality again.
Yeah, it's funny that I was aware, and a lot of people I know were aware that this was going to happen, right? Going back to 2011, 2012, because that was their plan. It's always been their plan for years. And we've information to actually show you know, a newspaper article back in 2012 saying mandatory vaccines with Bill Gates on the front, which is the sovereign independent newsletter. So we knew they wanted to do it. And they tried it with the avian flu, and they tried it with the swine flu, and they tried it with Ebola. And they just didn't take, but for some reason the COVID did. And with the push of the media and obviously the politicians and the ignorance involved as well, because I suppose we need to talk about that, Gloria and Catherine, as well, because there's a lot of people, and again, getting into the psychology, that, and one of the things that I've come across, which is what my system, I call the fluid belief system, is that people have such an investment in their training, like a solicitor or maybe a nurse or doctor, that when you come and give them information that goes against years of their programming and training and indoctrination, they will argue the point and go, well, don't be silly. And there was situations with that, with COVID, that nurses and doctors were being given information that went against their indoctrination, and they wouldn't believe it because they were so invested in the training that they wouldn't challenge their own belief system, which is what I talk about, you know, being able to park the ego and challenge your belief system. And Aristotle, which is what I always use that quote, the mark of an educated mind is to be able to entertain the thought without accepting it. So to be able to entertain information that challenges your belief system, and then you can say, well, I'm not asking people to believe it, I'm saying entertain it, but go and look at the research or the evidence that you have and see what you think. So, Gloria, where do we fit in with that? Because to critically think, I mean, to think in itself takes energy. And a lot of people didn't want to think. They outsourced their thinking to the government. So, you know, so if we're in the corner, it's trying to, how do you get people to critically think? And how do you get people to say, look, we know you've been indoctrinated for years and you've been trained as a doctor, nurse, guard, legal person, but you have to be able to entertain information that challenges your training and your belief system. Where does the critical thinking fit in there?
Well, many people would say that critical thinking begins in education. And we could point to education as something that has been failing populations for a large number of years, whether we're talking about schools or whether we're talking about university education. And you probably heard, as your listeners too, many people refer to education today, not so much as education, but indoctrination. And I think there's actually a lot of evidence to support that, that children are not being taught to critically think. And that's not just a gross generalisation on my part. We know that that's the case. So if we look at the case of the United Kingdom, for example, then we know that the national curriculum, which is the curriculum set down by the state, we know that the teaching of critical thinking actually only features in relation to three subjects in the national curriculum in the UK. And even then, there's only cursory mention of critical thinking. This is extraordinary, when many listeners might think that critical thinking is actually the core of all education. But anyway, here we have the national curriculum in the UK that only references critical thinking in relation to three topics, which are art and design, citizenship, and history. And it gets no mention, for example, in science. So here we have COVID, which is rooted in, let's say, science, and the pupils will not have been taught to think critically as part of their school education. And then we move to the university level, and I can talk extensively and in greater detail about what's going on in schools, because I undertook I decided to take on the task of looking at secondary school textbooks. I had this pile of secondary school textbooks on my desk, and the textbooks spanned all areas of the curriculum, from the humanities, English and modern languages, right through to maths and the sciences and history. And I can share some of the conclusions from that. They're very stark and disturbing, I have to say, the conclusions from that report. But if we move on briefly, in terms of introductory comments, the stage after school for many people is university. And a study carried out only a few months ago, at the end of August, in fact, 2022, by the OECD. This was a six-country study that included the US and the UK, and a very large study which had a sample of 800,000 graduates. It's a very large number across these six countries. And what the authors of the report were looking to see was the incidence of critical thinking at the point of graduation. And the stark findings from this report, very recent as I say, very disturbing findings, was that actually only 45% of graduates demonstrated critical thinking skills. Now that's obviously under 50%. So they were saying that less than half of the sample had critical thinking skills. They also said there was very little learning gain between critical thinking skills in the undergraduates at the start of their degree and the critical thinking skills of those same students on the point of graduation. So if you're looking for a cause, I would say we couldn't avoid taking a look at what's going on in education. And as I say, I'm very happy to talk more about school textbooks and some of the findings from the report. And I'm also very happy to talk about what's happening in universities. The book you mentioned, Lightbulb Moments and the Power of Critical Thinking, has been published by Truth University Press. And another book published by Truth University Press is entitled The Dark Side of Academia, How Truth is Suppressed, which is very relevant to your question, Alan.
Yeah,
The Dark Side of Academia, How Truth is Suppressed. The author of that is the Secret Professor, and there's a foreword by John Hamer, who's a fine historian, writer of geopolitical matters. And there's an afterword by Dr. Tess Laurie. And Dr. Tess Laurie, who is a fine researcher herself, quite a prolific researcher, she refers to universities and how she perceives them today. And I'm just going to quote here from the afterword that she wrote to this book, The Dark Side of Academia, which incidentally can be obtained from Truth University Press directly. And the email is one you read out earlier. Mm. Thank you, Alan. It's info@protonmail.com. And what Dr. Tess Laurie writes is that, quotes, after reading The Dark Side of Academia, I've come to the conclusion that critical thinking and genius have been long banished by these legacy institutions that are rotted to the core and now in need of dismantling before they do any further damage to young minds. And as many of your listeners will know, Dr. Tess Laurie is the founder of a very significant initiative to reform our health system by bringing empowerment to individuals by giving them information on how they can maintain their health. And incidentally, Catherine Armitage, my co-author, is a great expert on that. So I think not just myself, but many people would point a finger at our education system.
Yeah, totally.
Which has been failing us.
It's what we normally say. They teach you what to think rather than how to think. And without getting into the finer points of the educational system and the books, I think the overview of it is that we know that the educational system makes good servants. And, especially when it comes to authority, obey authority, whether that's a priest or whether it's a guard or whether it's a teacher, that's the way the system has been set up and part of. So the indoctrination system. So as soon as kids start school at the age of 5 or whatever, straight away, the indoctrination is put into them there, and this is what you have to think, and we're not going to teach you how to be creative or be a critical thinker. This is it. This is the way it is. I totally agree. There was a statement that was made there I seen a few years ago, and apparently in the early 1900s, the comment was made that they were making too many Nikola Teslas, so they had to dumb down the education system because people were being too smart. And if we actually went back to the educational system in the late 1800s, I mean, the level of questioning, the questions they have and the education they had was phenomenal compared to the way we have it now, the way it's all dumbed down and watered down. And obviously, you know,
well,
that's...
absolutely. And watered down by design, as you say.
Of course.
People were getting too bright. And it was Rockefeller who said at the beginning of the 20th century, I don't want a nation of thinkers.
Yeah.
I want a nation of workers. So he said it. He doesn't want a nation of thinkers, critical thinkers.
Yeah.
No, why would he? And the book quotes Frederick the Great of Prussia, who was a great warmonger. Was Frederick the Great of Prussia. And he said, if my soldiers were to begin to think, there we have the word think again, if my soldiers were to begin to think, not one of them would remain in the army.
Totally, totally agree. I'll go off to Catherine. Catherine, I want to get your take on that as well, because the whole process of critical thinking and, you know, to think takes energy. And I always say this to people. We, over COVID especially, was a complete obvious implementation of people outsourcing their thinking to the government. And I can't be bothered, you know, with that attitude, and let the government do my thinking for me and I'll just do what they tell me to do. And that's just, to me, a lack of putting energy into thinking. And it's a lot of people just did that. So where does it fit in your thoughts regarding critical thinking and applying energy and everything else?
Yes, it's a big subject. I mean, Gloria's covered a lot of points. There are two pieces specifically by educators in the book. One is by Dr. Ursula Edgington, and the title of her piece is very relevant to what we're talking about. She actually goes so far as to say, is there fakery in teaching, learning and research? Are colleges and universities a house of cards? And she actually changed the title of her piece as she went along, and well, as she developed it. And we were fully in agreement with her going that far in her title. She also talks about the lack of transparency in, she says here, with regards to further education and higher education policies, recording a student as present on arbitrarily important term dates when in fact the student was absent or withdrawn from a course because attendance ensures continued course funding. Number two, encouraging students to record positive feedback on their course evaluations because the outcomes from these surveys are reflected in the university's profile score and helps their potential and hence their potential future employment prospects. And lack of transparent assessing and grading criteria. So altogether, the whole educational process is taken away from what we would see, let's say, in the Middle Ages. There's another piece by Matthew Errett, and he talks about the Platonic education model, you could say, questioning everything. That's actually a quotation from Einstein, but you could apply that to Plato. And also Gloria is going to talk about the earlier philosophers, but the critical thinking in education came from their experiences originally. So, for example, Thomas Aquinas, when it came to critical, he says, or this is about him, in the Middle Ages, the tradition of systematic critical thinking was embodied in the writings and teachings of such thinkers as Thomas Aquinas, who wrote the Summa Theologica, who, to ensure his thinking met the test of critical thought, always systematically stated, considered, and answered all criticisms of his ideas, as a necessary stage in developing them. And of course, what we've got now is people, when, as you spoke about earlier with Gloria, when people are questioned, they shut down or they don't allow their mind to be open. I think there's a joke, isn't there, about the mind is like a parachute. You have to open it to make it work.
It works better when it's open, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that having been through my journey and learning homeopathy, that really taught me to keep an open mind. And it also taught me to question all the orthodox medical thinking, which I'd been brought up with. And I gradually, and I think this is the thing, in COVID, people haven't had time to really stand back. It's all been coming so thick and fast. I think Gloria and I were very lucky in that we've had years and years of thinking critically and questioning everything to come to the conclusions that there was something that wasn't quite right. Some people haven't had the luxury of that because it's all been foisted on them in the last 3 years, and they're still reeling from the effects of it all.
You know what? I'm making notes here because as we're talking, I'm coming up with different things to talk to the two of you about it. And going back to what Gloria just said there about the whole bottom line and make sure there it's good reporting and the level of students being there at the college for funding, it's kind of it's institutional survival and the bottom line again, where the corporate attitude comes in, you know, profit and all that and survival. And I just wanted to throw that in. But what I said to people was, and Gloria, this is important, and I think for me anyway, it's important. And Catherine, when you wake up, when you realize the world is not the way it is, right, and there's something going on. Like in the Wizard of Oz, you have this big scary man, you know, saying, you know, I'm the wizard. And then all of a sudden when you pull the curtain away and you realize it's only a man in a machine trying to, you know, frighten people. So when people look through the curtain and they see the world and realize that actually the world is not the way it is, you obviously run around with the information you've researched and you give it to your friends and family and they call you a conspiracy theorist and everything else, right? So this is why I took a step back and went and looked at the psychology of the mind, because that wasn't working. And when I started applying the psychology, so it didn't matter. Don't argue over whether the moon is made of cheese. It doesn't matter. Talk about whether the person you're trying to wake up or give information to has the ability to even open their mind and to challenge their own belief systems. Because a lot of them were saying, oh, I have an open mind. Here's something that challenges your belief system. And they close down. Cognitive dissonance kicks in because, oh, that's too scary. I'd rather believe the comfortable lies than the uncomfortable truth. So the whole idea, what I did with the fluid belief system, and critical thinking is, I would say, fits in, is that it's like when somebody tells you how to do the magic trick, because the governments of the world, the sage, they use this, you know, the fear to frighten people all the time, right? Okay, and that was the whole idea. So my approach was saying, okay, I'm going to show you how the magic trick is done. I'm going to show you how the government use this magic trick on you. And then when you know how the magic trick is done, no matter how many times they keep trying to do the magic trick and cut the girl in half, once you know how the trick is done, you won't be fooled because you know how the trick is done. So my approach to what's going on that regarding the waking up process and all that was to start going back to basics and applying the psychology and giving people the tools from a psychological point of view to show them how the tricks are done. And I don't know, you know, critical thinking is obviously, you know, one of these things, because they knew that if they could shut down the mind and stop people thinking, then that's where the fear comes in. So would you kind of agree with that presumption to actually a method to apply the psychology. Don't really focus too much on the information, because I think you'll argue all night over information, in all honesty, and I've been there where you argue all night and nobody wins. But when you start applying the psychology of how the mind works, all of a sudden the people change because you're applying logic.
Well, yes, psychology has played an enormous part in the last 3 years. And arguably, the controllers in a number of countries globally are aware of the psychology regarding group conformity. And there's an enormous and very important body of work on group conformity that essentially tells us that humans are conformist by and large and will believe something even where there's strong evidence against it. And they will believe in order to conform and not be outlawed by their peers. And I could discuss some of this research if you'd like, Alan, because it really helps us understand some of the processes that have taken place over the last 3 years. And I suppose people understanding this research on conformity, that just understanding that will, I hope, give people the strength to resist the efforts to force people into a state of conformity. And of course, imposing mandates on people is a way of reinforcing that conformity. But of course, there were people in the population who resisted. And I do think I agree with you absolutely that when people understand the mechanisms that, say, force conformity, then it may be easier for them to resist those efforts when they come again. So I'm quite happy to go through some of the landmark studies if you think that would be helpful.
Well, let's take one of them and apply it to what happened over the last 3 years. So let's take one sample and let's talk about that and apply the method they used and the conformity part. And obviously, let's discuss that. Because there's other things that we want to be discussing as well. So let's take one of them as an example over the last 3 years and let's look into the mechanics of how they applied it.
Well, yeah, okay. So let's take one of the early experiments by Solomon Asch. You may be aware of this in 1951. It's quite a well-known experiment. And what Solomon Asch did was present people with a series of lines, three lines, in fact, and the subjects were asked to indicate which of these three lines was similar or different in length to a third line. Okay. And if you saw the lines, the answer is absolutely manifest. If you were asked which of the three lines was similar in length to the third line, well, the first time that the subjects were asked to do this, they were asked to do this when they were on their own, completely on their own, and those people registered the correct answer 99% of the time, okay?
Yeah.
But then the study kicked in, and what Solomon Asch did was he arranged for confederates to come into the room, and they actually outnumbered the subject. So there might be one innocent subject there, and all the others in the room were confederates who had been asked by Solomon Asch to deliver the wrong answer to this very simple question. And when that happened and the individual was on their own, faced with a majority of people in the room who were giving the wrong answer, 76% of the subjects, because he repeated this study on many occasions, registered the wrong answer. So the correct answer dropped from 99% of the time when the subjects were on their own down to 76. So, and this was a very, very simple question. It didn't need a lot of judgment at all. But how can I relate this to COVID? Well, what we found in these studies was that when just one of the Confederates, instead of always giving the wrong answer, when just one of the Confederates gave a correct answer and told the truth, rather than none of them telling the truth, then the conformity levels amongst the subjects dropped way down to 10%. Mm. So what can we learn? If we if the government wants to build on the findings of Solomat, they will ensure that there is no debate, and so that the, if you like, the wrong answer dominates with no counter narrative to oppose it, if you follow what I'm saying. And so what we need to do is always force debate, because the minute we have a second voice that actually speaks the truth, then the false narrative will struggle to survive. So I think that's that's one very important lesson that comes out of this remarkable research on conformity.
Okay, but I think what they did is obviously, and I'll get Catherine in now to discuss this, but what they did purposely was they were only pushing out one side of the narrative. They were not allowing for debate. They weren't letting you hear the other side of the narrative because it was all controlled. Catherine, this was obviously going on when we've seen it. What they did is they weren't allowing for the other side of the narrative to be said, because there's always two sides to every story, if not three. And I always use this example all the time. And I say to people, again, applying psychology, if you have two kids playing in the room next door and you hear something smashing and you go in and the two kids are blaming each other, you don't just listen to one of the kids and say what happened. You listen to both of them and you form an opinion based on both sides of the argument. That's logical. And when I say that to people, they go, well, that makes sense. Then I say, then why did you only listen to one half of what the government was saying, one side of the narrative? So what's your take on that, Catherine?
Yeah, I think this is so true. I remember my son in the playground coming to me and I found his hood was ripped off his coat, and his friend also has his hood ripped off his coat. So I did exactly what you said. I said, okay, let's hear both your stories here now. And of course, they both, well, what turned out is they both ripped each other's hoods off. But they were able to both have a say in the matter. And I think that this is what hasn't happened. And, you know, going back to the Ash conformity experiment and how that relates to COVID, all the participants felt anxious in that experiment and feared the disapproval of others. And, you know, we only have to look, let's say, at Facebook to see. I mean, I remember because I did this thing on Facebook where I kept posting every day, every day, every day. And I still do that in our critical thinking group, just to put the other side across, the other argument across, so that it comes up in people's news feed, so that they have to take notice of it. Because otherwise, if it's not there and there are no dissenting voices, which as Gloria's just said, it's the dissenting voice that break the conformity. So it's hugely important.
Yeah, no, totally. And I totally agree that a lot of people, the conformity and part of it is not to look stupid and not to speak up, because what will people think? What will the neighbours say? What will the neighbours think? And I've seen this as an example in a health and safety video regarding an experiment where it was supposed to be in a room where people were being interviewed, and they had a number of actors, and then one person who's genuine would come in and the fire alarm would go off. And because nobody else was getting up to run, that person stayed where they were because they didn't want to look foolish or silly. And the problem is that, and I talk to people about this, people who are insecure or have low self-esteem. And again, we go to the psychology, Glory, about this. People who are insecure, low self-esteem, they're concerned about what other people think of them. And I always say, look, you know, the 33% rule applies to everything, in my eyes anyway. 33% of people will like you, 33% of people won't like you, and 33% of people will be sitting on the fence. The people you should care about are the people who like you, the people who don't like you will never like you, and the people on the fence, let them make up their own mind. And because you know, Gloria, what it's like when people go dating and they put on the psychological mask and they put on a personality that person wants them so they're liked with that person. So they put on the fake personality. And then 6 months down the line, their new partner turns around and goes, you're not the same person that I met on their date night on the first few nights. And I keep saying to people, stop trying to be somebody else because you'll attract the wrong people to you. Start being yourself, put out that energy, and just accept the fact that some people won't like you. We can't get on with everybody. So there's no point trying to please everybody. And there are people pleasers out there. Just be yourself, be your own energy. And, you know, and that's what I normally say to people, because otherwise you're trying to please loads of people, or you're worried what people say. You know, at the end of the day, sometimes you just have to get to the stage and say, look, I don't care. What's your thoughts on that, Gloria?
Well, I think people need to be themselves, because truth will out in the end, and it's difficult to keep a mask on forever. But, you know, I do also accept what you said earlier, that people tend to be happiest with other people who are like themselves.
Yeah.
And so to that extent, and there's a lot of psychology to back that up. I've looked at the evidence and written extensively about it, that there are research studies that have found that opposites attract, and also that like attracts like. And on balance, the evidence seems to be favouring the second, i.e. like attracting like, rather than opposites attracting. And so, yes, you can understand why people might think they should put on a face, but in the end, the mask will come off, and it's better to be honest and try and find people like yourself, as you say. That people come in many and different forms, don't they? Different personality types abound, and it better if people can find their tribe and associate it with like minds, because this like attracts like principle in psychology is so strong. And I spent over 20 years looking at the designs that people created and the designs that people preferred. And people hadn't done this research before. And what I found over and over again, and the statistics, Alan, were off the wall, was that men would invariably prefer designs that have been created by men, and conversely, women would prefer designs that have been created by women. And the people who were involved in these studies had no idea that I was looking at the effects of gender. But they come through clearly, because if you, in the work I'd done comparing the designs created by men and created by women, they were, to a great extent, literally poles apart. You know, women would use more colours, more two-dimension, a lot of detail and rounded shapes, whereas men tended to use straight lines, fewer colours, and much less detail. So, I mean, there was some exceptions to these differences, but by and large, this is what I found over these 20 years of doing the research. And so it's not surprising to find women gravitate to the designs that women had created, and men to gravitate to those that men had created. And I just finished with one point. I did actually carry out an informal study with some of the students on whose work I was using to compare the creations of the male and the females. And I had a sample of design students there who designed some chocolate boxes. And they showed these differences that I just talked about. You know, the female students designed chocolate boxes that were oval or round. No, really, believe me when I say this. And the male students had designed rectangular-shaped containers for their chocolate boxes. And I thought I would just feed back to them the results of this study, you know, and the differences that I'd found between the male and the female created designs. And I asked them, now that you know these differences, I would like you men to imagine that you're females, and I would like you to create chocolate boxes with the same characteristics that I mentioned that females tended to prefer, i.e. boxes that were round and had lots of detail and two-dimensional infeel. And I said the same to the females. Could you please pretend that you're male designers and use in your new chocolate boxes the features that typify the designs created by males. And what did I find? The results on the part of both the males and the female designs were completely hopeless. I mean, nobody would have bought these chocolate boxes. So what was the lesson that I learned from that? It's very difficult for people to pretend to be other than they actually are. And that seemed to be true of these designers, just as much as you say it's true of humans who are dating.
Mm. It's something that I come across on a regular basis, the masks that people wear. And I'm going to be doing a Rumble video actually on not just the masking, but I'm going to be talking about the zones as well, the four zones that we use, because we're fundamentally animals anyway, Homo sapiens. So we have the public zone, the social zone, the friendship zone and the intimate zone. And I'm going to be talking about that. But I want to get back to the whole idea of critical thinking. You know, if we could activate the switch in people, to flick that switch on for critical thinking, I think the world would probably change overnight. I'd like to think so. How can we activate that switch? How can we put that light bulb on with a critical thinking switch and get them thinking?
Well, I mean, we don't need to look very far to find an answer to that. Because just a few years ago, in 2018, researchers at the Medical University of Vienna did actually do research on that very question. And the head of the research project was one Dr. Christian Windischberger. And he and his colleagues used an fMRI scan to record the brain activity of 29 people who were solving problems designed to elicit a light bulb moment. And this was the first time this had been done. And the scans, this is very exciting, clearly revealed that the part of the brain involved in producing the light bulb moments was the prefrontal cortex, which I think is something you've mentioned earlier, Alan. Mm. And that's the region that covers the front part of the frontal lobe. And that is the part of the brain that we know already is involved in activities such as planning complex cognitive behavior, involved in decision making and personality expression. So, if you like, it's not surprising that Windischberger and his colleagues found this to be the case, but it just confirms that this is where critical thinking takes place. And one of the objectives of Catherine and I in this book was to isolate beyond those physical factors the very specific triggers that would ignite critical thinking, because this is the all-important question before us today. So what we did was we collected, and Catherine's already alluded to a couple of these, we collected the thoughts of 24 people and their thinking journeys, their critical thinking journeys. And these are people who started off in life perhaps believing what they'd been taught at school, and then through a series of incidents they came to question the reality that was presented before them. I'm one of the 24, Catherine's another, and there are some remarkable people here. There's Justin Walker, he's talking about the money system. Sir Julian Rose, he's talking about organic farming, regenerative farming. Catherine talks about health, as does Eve Gilmore. We have writers on education. We have John Hamer talking about his awakening and to history and real history, if you like. And Neil Cramer talks about how the evil in the world can actually serve as a trigger to get us thinking. But in the course of analysing these 24 thought pieces, which, if you like, are a kind of data set, what we did was drawing on findings from an online survey that I'd run on the website of Truth University, and that's www.truthuniversity.co.uk. I'd put up a survey asking people to describe some of the triggers to their coming of age, if you like, in terms of being a critical thinker. And what we found was that the factors that they mentioned as triggering their awakenings were very similar, very closely correlated with those factors that triggered the awakenings of our 24 people. And I'll just outline these factors, and then maybe Catherine could give examples from the individual contributions that we had. So one of the factors identified by the 74 online survey respondents on truthuniversity.co.uk was having an innate sense of curiosity and also a desire for autonomy. That was very interesting. Distrust of authority was another feature that surfaced from the online survey respondents. Placing a premium on the truth. That was interesting. These seemed to be people who were really interested in ferreting out the truth. And that, and with that went a high sense of morality, an ability to, or desire, to see the big picture. Here's an interesting one, which ties in, I think, with your quote from Aristotle, a willingness to change one's mind.
Oh, yeah.
A willingness not to be stuck in, say, the results of your medical training. Mm. And there were just three more. A strong sense of justice was another theme that emerged, both from our 24 contributors and also the 74 online survey respondents. High intelligence also featured, as also an interest in history. So, if you like, these are the triggers. And if we had an education system, for example, that triggered any of these, for example, curiosity or autonomy or distrust of authority rather than forcing pupils to be strictly conforming with authority, then we might facilitate, I would suggest, a shift to more critical thinking.
Yeah, well, what got me thinking there, and I'll go off to Catherine for this. You see, I always say, and this has been said by others, not just me, that it's really not the gut, it's not really got to do with intelligence, really. It's got to do with perception. And perception is your belief system that you have been brought up with as a child. So your mum and dad, your teacher, your friends and family. So if you grew up thinking that 2 and 2 is 5, and you've been told that and programmed all your life that 2 and 2 is 5, and somebody like me comes along and tells you that 2 and 2 is 4, really, it's not really got to do with intelligence. It's your belief system. You've been given your belief system, and you form it up to, I think it's up to the age of 7, and you form your belief system. So, you know, and you don't need to be, have an IQ of 150 to work out, you know, logically if something's wrong, if you're given the evidence and, you know, it's done in the proper way. So, and I always say to people, and this is why you have academics, unfortunately, who have, you know, a highly qualified, loads of qualifications, maybe high IQs, and they don't get it because it's not related to intelligence, but more your belief system and your perception. Catherine, what's your take on that?
Yes, yeah, it's really interesting, this. And Gloria's looked very much at the triggers that promote critical thinking in people. And what we also have talked about, but I think it needs going through, maybe going over again, is the what the obstacles to critical thinking are, which we cover in the first part of the book. Gloria covers in the first part of the book, because she wrote about this because of her background in education and academia, and the factors that we've talked about, which drive conformity, information conformity, which is illustrated by Deutsch and Gerard in 1955, a process that describes people's tendency to conform because the issues are complex. And you mentioned earlier, Alan, that people, they're tired. You know, it takes some effort to think.
Yeah.
And there are three things which link to this. One is decision fatigue. And when we're being bombarded with so much information from so many different directions, which we are now in the Aquarian age, we can be on so many different channels, and the younger generation sometimes on several at the same time while they're doing their homework. there's decision fatigue, cognitive load, which was studied by Sweller in 2010. These are all parts of the book that have been researched by Gloria. Concepts in turn related to Nobel laureate Kahneman's description of people as cognitively lazy. You know, this has actually been studied.
Wow, yeah.
When it gets too much, people just can't take it anymore. And then, you know, as we know from the work of people like Edward Bernays, you know, his books, Propaganda, Public Relations, they are using these techniques to shut people down. But on the positive side, you also talked about self-awareness. As a yoga teacher, I would say that that is one of the biggest things also that ties in with being able to stay independent, stay thinking independently, and noticing that maybe we are in a state of anxiety, but not letting that, you could say, get to us. You know, techniques such as meditation, yoga, help the mind stay calm in when it's under a lot of pressure, and to bring it back to a place where critical thinking decisions can be made. So yes, I don't know if that answers your question, but
I'd also like to.
If I could just add.
Can I just add one more thing to Catherine's list there?
Yes.
The one thing I'd like to add to that, Catherine, is poverty, because when people
because when people are,
you know, they always say people who are struggling won't rebel, and they like keeping people down with the foot on top of them, which is poverty. They're fighting to pay their bills. Thanks, my cup of tea's coming. And if you're fighting to pay your bills and robbing Peter to pay Paul and all that, you can't critically think because you're too worried about what's happening. So that there in itself is another thing to add to the list. And I know Gloria wants to come in there. I'd also like to say we can't really change the dynamics of the physical body. You know, we know that the prefrontal cortex, if that gets shut down, it'll actually, you know, with fight flight mode, fear, you know, that's just how our bodies work. But so my approach, and I think Gloria alluded to it there earlier on, was if you give people the magic trick of the information of what's going on and say, look, the government are going to do this thing and they're going to come out and they're going to bring out loads of fear, and your body works this way and you're going to go into fear because your critical thinking is going to be shut down. So if we give them the tools and let them know what's going to happen before it happens, or what the government, the tricks that the governments are doing to put people in fear, surely that has to be one method out of a few, that we give them the tools and they realize, oh, Alan said, or Gloria said, or Catherine said that the government were going to do this and I would go into fear because of this. But I know what's happening. I know the magic trick. I'm not going to be fooled. Gloria.
I think that's absolutely brilliant as a strategy. To reveal the techniques that are used by the controllers is a way of alerting people to techniques that will be used against them, or may be used against them. And I think one of the other tools that we can use, apart from raising awareness of the tools that have been used for centuries, and I talked about Edmund Burke earlier, who talked about the way that governments like to use fear because it renders people stupid. And likewise, John Adams, the second president of the United States, he commented similarly. I think one of the other tools we could use, as well as raising awareness of what governments can do, is to actually give people techniques that they can use. And in an ideal world, these techniques would be used on a regular basis in our education system. And they would be the use of questions. I mean, Einstein talked about the importance of questioning everything. Those are his words. Einstein said, question everything. Jung, he said that the ability to ask questions is the greatest resource in learning the truth. And so, I should add that even the BBC, bless them, have said that critical thinking involves questioning rather than simply accepting information that you hear or read. You know, it'd be interesting if they did a bit of questioning themselves. But the lesson from Jung, from Einstein, even from the BBC, is that questioning is the key to critical thinking. So if we could teach people to use simple words like why, how, when, then we might be well on our way, I think.
Definitely. Well, here's something that I want to give people who, and yourself, Gloria and Catherine probably know this already, but I come from a corporate background, and part of being in the corporate world is learning when you're in the public eye to do various things. And the likes of Boris Johnson and all these politicians all have their spin doctors in the background. And I want people after the show, I want you to go and have a look at this on the internet. Go to Google and type in Boris Johnson and watch. You'll see him with a shirt on. Now, one of the tricks they do is they say to them, right, and this is what they'd probably say to Boris when he was in power. And other politicians do this as well. They say, Boris, what you need to do is, when there's a crisis, you have to go in with your shirt sleeves up, but make sure they're not above your elbow. Because if they're above your elbow, you're one of the workers. You want to be seen to be in control as the supervisor. So you have to keep your shirt below the elbow. And it looks like you're in control, but you're there to get stuck in and do the work. This is one of many techniques the spin doctors use. And when I was saying to you, Gloria, about giving people the tools or the knowledge of the tricks that these people use, when they see a politician coming out and doing that, they'll be able to go, yeah, that's a spin doctor. That's a scam. We know that your spin doctor told you to do that. That's a load of BS. That's my Absolutely. Kind of point, yeah.
Yes, I think that's right. And one of our friends, actually, he's got a very good technique. His four adult children, none of them were aware of what was going on. And what he decided to do was write a list that they could put each one of them on their fridges, and they could use it as a checklist as these various events happened. And that has helped enormously to bring awareness. So going along with what you're saying, exposing the techniques really does help. And then that in turn helps to bring the information to the forefront so that people start to question. Again, Absolutely. And in fact, it can be a game. Humor is brilliant because you can make a laugh of some of these things which people are taking terribly seriously, and that brings back, it helps to overcome the fear, and then people can see it in a different light.
And and this is where education could again play a big role if it was minded to do so, or should I say allowed to do so. So, for example, when people are being taught about literary techniques when they're learning English, and they're taught about the rule of three, you know, how it's very effective rhetorical device to have your words listed in groups of three, like Julius Caesar, I came, I saw, I conquered. Mm. You know, that's a phrase in three parts. Well, people could be invited to look at the vocabulary of COVID. I wrote an article on that subject at one point, and see how some of these rhetorical or literary devices were actually evident in the language of COVID. And just to give you one example, we had here in the UK the mantra, stay alert, control the virus, save lives. So there again, we have this famous rule of three. When I sit on public transport, this recording beams out over the airwaves. See it, say it, sorted. So there's got a group of three again, and we have an additional technique in there, which is alliteration, the use of the repeated S. See it, say it, sort it. And we saw that alliterative device used in the phrase, the new normal. You know, the N repeated in those two words, new normal. Now, if people could be invited to spot these techniques, these literary techniques, then again, I think it would help reveal the propagandistic techniques that are being used to underpin the narrative going out about COVID.
Yeah.
And then finally,
yeah,
we know that Goebbels, who was the Minister of Propaganda in Germany,
yeah,
from 1933 to 1945, he said, if you repeat a lie often enough, it becomes the truth. So you could ask people to notice how often these messages are being repeated. And they would very quickly discover that they're being repeated on a extraordinary level.
Yeah.
That's right. One of the ones which it would have made me laugh more if it hadn't been so serious was in the local papers here in Bedford and down in Devon. There was a huge paid advertisement from the government. It took up at least, you know, half, two pages, the centre sort of thing in the paper. COVID, act like you've got it.
Mm.
And, you know, people, if they understand that these are government paid adverts, it's like, what? And what are they leaving out? You know, as a health practitioner, health has got very little to do with a jab. It's got to do with what you put into your body. They left out so much information and censored so many people. You know, Mercola, he's had his platforms taken down, YouTube channel taken away, because everything that he was saying would promote people's critical thinking, in fact.
Mm. Well,
exactly.
Yeah.
And another, can I just add one other thing we've done in the book, which we talked about the triggers earlier, which we deduced both from the responses of the online survey respondents, but also from the 24 contributions in the book. But there was a third source that we drew on, which was the thinking journeys of literary heroes of famous books, such as 1984, Brave New World, and Fahrenheit 451. And we looked to see what mental processes the authors of those books had assumed in their heroes. And we found, would you believe it, a very high correlation between what we found in our 24 and our online survey respondents, and also heroes like Winston Smith, that all these literary heroes were showing the same tendencies to curiosity, truth-seeking, interest in history. But the reason I mention this is because we know that in 1984 by George Orwell, the language of the day was newspeak. And if you visit the end of the book, you'll see that George Orwell actually has an essay about newspeak and the elements in newspeak. And it's a very fascinating exercise to actually compare the elements he says make up newspeak with the language of COVID. So one of the aspects of newspeak is the use of very concrete words. And we saw that in the quote that Catherine gave us just now. There was a very concrete word, act.
Yeah.
Mm.
And that was typical of the language of newspeak. Another aspect of newspeak is to create terms which give the illusion of pseudoscience.
Mm. Well, and I mean, sure, conspiracy theorists.
Many examples of that.
Well, conspiracy theorists was the classic one in the 60s, when they were, you know, the media were questioning the JFK killing, and there was too much media interest, so the FBI or CIA put together conspiracy theorists and then pushed that out there, and then anybody who started questioning things, you know, you are called a conspiracy theorist. So we got these people who are repeaters, and they would just hear these two words put together, or whatever word they want to push out there, even with COVID. Granny killer was one of them. You know, you're not caring about your friends and family. But the one thing I came across during my research, and again, I'd like both you to have your thoughts on it. We do have questions coming in. I do want to get to the questions. I'm watching the time there. We've got another 30 minutes anyway, but I do want to get to the questions. But the one thing I came across in my research And again, it's objective information because it is actually researched. And it comes over. It's got to do with the people. When you give them information, solid information, like the doctors and all, that you've been lied to. What I have came across on my research is that not knowing something for some people is a weakness. So instead of saying, I don't know, to some people is a weakness, they would cover up and say, oh, that's a load of rubbish, or that's a load of BS, whatever. And so there's two thought processes. The person who says, I don't know enough about it to comment, is showing confidence in their intellect to show a weakness to say they don't know. Where the person who says, oh, that's a load of rubbish, means that they're actually showing a weakness in their intellect and they're covering it up by saying it's a load of BS. And by applying the fluid belief system, which is what I talk about, you know, they're either going to answer, there's only two ways to answer something. So what I would do is I'd give them a very big question, like, do you agree that the world is being controlled by a group of elites? That's a very big question to give them. And based on their reply will tell me psychologically exactly where their mind is at. So, you know, again, I don't know how the critical thinking. See, I think, and this is just my thoughts, Gloria, and I could be wrong, Catherine. Critical thinking is the second process of being, having an open mind. And allowing for your belief system to be challenged. Because if they won't challenge their belief system, then critical thinking is not going to work. Because they shut down.
I think it can. Yes, it's all about helping people to become aware of anomalies. So that's also something that can be done without challenging their belief system too much. It can just be small things.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. In one of the contributions, actually it's the first one by myself, I talk about how my process, my very personal process of starting to ask questions was ignited by the process of spotting anomalies. So exactly as Catherine said, that is a very powerful way, and it needn't necessarily disturb your underlying paradigm or belief systems. And I could provide a couple of examples if you wanted, if you felt there was time. One of these would be the example I give in the book of the Great Fire of London and how I came to question the truthfulness of the mainstream narrative that I think children, certainly around the UK, have been taught for generations, namely that the Great Fire of London 1666 was actually started through the negligence of one Thomas Farriner in Pudding Lane. He was a navy baker. And as I asked, as I saw increasing numbers of anomalies, I was inescapably drawn to the conclusion that actually, far from being started by accident, this horrendous fire was started on purpose. Mm. I didn't get there in one, if you like, Alan.
Yeah.
I got there, as Catherine said so astutely, I got there by spotting anomalies. And I can give you a couple of examples, if you like. One of the contemporary sources writing about the Great Fire was a nonconformist minister by the name of Thomas Vincent. And he, and also John Evelyn, the diarist, both commented that there was a strong easterly wind. In other words, a wind blowing from east to west. And yet, what we saw over the 5 days of the fire was the fact that the fire was spreading from west to east and also in a northerly direction. Well, how on earth is that consistent with the information from Thomas Vincent and John Evelyn that the fire was blowing from east to west? And so just spotting an anomaly like that, or again, this is what started me off on this subject. I was interested in the fact that Sir Christopher Wren, whose career was built substantially on the back of the fire. I mean, before the fire, he'd been a mathematician and an astronomer, and that was all. After the fire, he started to be known as Britain's greatest architect. What I discovered was that he lived into his 90s, But there's, in fact, between June 1665, the year before the fire, and March 1666, that's a 10-month period, Wren spent those 10 months in Paris collecting information on urban design. And he actually wrote in a letter that he came back from France with almost all France on paper. Well, that struck me as very anomalous, because he came back in March 1666, just a few months in time, if you like, for the outbreak of fire at the beginning of September, the 2nd of September. And just give one further example of an anomaly. The fire broke out on the 2nd of September, and the day before, there was a very important reservoir in Islington in North London. Somebody by the name of John Gaunt, who was a newly appointed trustee of the New River Company, and that's a company that had diverted water into a reservoir in Islington. John Gaunt, he turned off the water supply in the reservoir in Islington. He locked the door and he disappeared, taking the keys with him. So that meant that when the fire broke out the following day, the obvious source of water for putting it out wasn't available. People had to queue by the Thames with buckets and endure the horrendous process of putting out the fire with buckets full of water from the Thames. Now, these are just a few of the many anomalies that I mention in my contribution in the book. And, you know, whatever your views of history, you know, I think as one perceives this growing number of anomalies, it's very difficult to keep to the conclusion that we've all taught at school, that the fire started through the negligence of Thomas Farrell.
Yeah, that sounds like a conspiracy theory to me, all right, if you look into that.
and I have to add, there's even what I like to think of as the smoking gun.
Yeah.
Because in Pudding Lane, which is famous as the place where Thomas Farrell had his bakery, melted pottery was found, a piece of melted pottery, which people claim was burnt at an enormously high temperature of 1,700 degrees Celsius. Well, I did a bit of research and found that pottery never melts at temperatures that go above 1,300 degrees Celsius. So how would we possibly explain this high temperature of this piece of pottery if it's not by suggesting that people at the time had techniques for manufacturing fire, which I'm quite confident they had, because at the very time that this fire was going on raging in London, the English were actually busy burning a town in Holland called Terschelling, and they destroyed innumerable ships and the town itself using fire. Mm. So there was obviously an ability in manufacturing fires at that very time in history.
I think you'd be going down the road to 9/11 and asking how the buildings collapsed with that fuel temperature, because they wouldn't burn the girders. Okay, ladies, we have questions. We have to get through the questions from the chat room, and so I'm going to quick fire them over to you, and I'll go Gloria Catherine, and then you can both give us your answer on these questions. So the first one to Gloria, Joan wants to know, have your guests listened to Jordan Peterson? He has an issues with the universities and the effects their teaching is having on the youth. Gloria, your thoughts?
Ah, yeah. Well, I would direct you to the book published by Truth University Press that I mentioned earlier. I don't know if you heard the first part of this interview, John. The book is called The Dark Side of Academia, How Truth is Suppressed. And what the book by the secret professor does is chart, if you like, the cover-ups that are taking place within higher education, whether it concerns history. I've mentioned the Great Fire of London. The book also discusses findings concerning the Dead Sea Scrolls, one of the most important archaeological discoveries of the last century, and the cover-ups about homeopathy, which is Catherine's field, and the discoveries by Jacques Benveniste, who was the amazing scientist who discovered that water has memory, the cover-ups about history, quite apart from the Great Fire of London, the cover-ups concerning the causes of the First World War. I mean, there are two outstanding authors called whose surnames are Doherty and McGregor, and the book describes their view based on the collection of copious evidence that Britain was substantially instrumental in fanning up the First World War. And the authors say that, and I've read the book, it's extraordinarily dense with evidence and very compelling, I have to say, in its evidence. They say that their publisher was amazed that the book was never reviewed by the mainstream media.
And it got out there.
And, and
it was actually released without having been censored.
It was released,
yeah,
but it didn't get any media coverage. And then it also discusses Carol Quigley's book, which, yes, it was also released by Macmillan, but it was such a thick book, the editor had never read it properly. And as soon as it was published and they discovered what the book actually said, and the book was predicting a Third World War, which arguably we're in at the moment, the publishers very hastily withdrew it from the shelves of bookshops and made sure that the proofs were never available for republication.
Okay,
and so, yes, cover up and the effects on youth. Well, if I just very quickly quote some remarkable thinkers, two. The philosopher Zizek, I mean, remarkable. He's written more than 50 books. And he now describes universities as factories producing experts. And he said that these factories producing experts stop free intellectual inquiry, and that this marks the end of intellectual life as we know it. He's a professor at Birkbeck College, London University. And Sir Roger Scruton, who's no longer alive today, he was similarly prolific compared to Professor Zizek. He wrote, I'm quoting him, "If the university renounces its calling in the matter of truth-directed argument, then we lose the university as an institution, and it becomes something else, indoctrination." Mm. And he described universities as losing all sense of their role as guardian of the intellectual life.
Yeah.
And he died in 2020, so unfortunately he can no longer contribute to the debate, but Truth University is an initiative growing in strength to address the closing down of critical thinking in higher education.
Okay. Yeah, look, I totally agree. Again, the indoctrination to the system. Catherine, your thoughts on Jordan Peterson and his thoughts on universities that affect the teaching to the youth?
Yes, I think Jordan Peterson is a critical thinker, and he very much encourages critical thinking. I've watched a few of his interviews, and he's also had his own personal problems, which he's overcome. And I think that can be a hallmark also of the critical thinker, where they've managed to overcome their own traumas in their lives, and they've got stronger as a result. I don't have much more to add. That's more Gloria's specialist subject than mine. But certainly it's what's left out of education that needs to be looked at the moment.
Yeah, I think there's the level of indoctrination. I know I've spoken to a few medical doctors who are now critical thinkers and who question the medical system. And when they had questions about, one of them is about sodium bicarbonate and that curing cancer. And he was just shut down straight away. And, you know, he was told, you know, don't go down that road. You're wasting your time. It's rubbish. And it turns out that was the thing that he actually took on himself and did his own research outside of his university studies and studies for being a doctor. And he's now, you know, helped hundreds of people fight cancer and remove it using sodium bicarb. So, you know, this is the thing. The one thing about not going to university is you don't have anybody telling you not to go and do something that, oh, it can't be done. I've heard that. I'm an IT guy by my corporate world, and I've heard it in the past before. Oh, you can't do that. And that might have come from a chap who went to, you know, consultant training or something in IT. And because I didn't do the same course, I just went ahead and tried it. And I got it working, where he was told by the book, no, that shouldn't work. So
that's so true. That's really interesting. I've got two things about that, because actually with my background, I did go to university, but left because I couldn't take it. Mm-hmm. And I went to study art. Mm-hmm. And I got a job actually as a textile designer in the West Indies. That was my first job. And the reason why I got the job is because the person who'd got the job, who had a university degree, didn't know how to actually solve the technical problem of the ink drying in the screens. But because I'd done a BTEC very practical diploma course where we had to do all the technical bits ourselves, making the screens and we knew the techniques, I could solve that problem straight away. So I think, you know, absolutely. And the other one that you brought up again through my homeopathy, many, many doctors criticized homeopathy. And there was a brilliant little Indian book. I worked for a homeopathic bookseller when I was studying, which was called Doctor's Conversions to Homeopathy or something like that. And these were all doctors who'd actually set out to discredit homeopathy, but ended up taking it on board and actually using homeopathy more than they used their orthodox medicine.
Yeah, no, look, this is quite common. I interviewed a lady called Dr. Diane Cochran, who interviewed over 1,000 people who had an NDE experience, near-death experience. And she said, it's amazing how many atheists came back spiritual. So
yes,
it's just kind of the experience, you know.
And Catherine will be talking about homeopathy and why this establishment might fear homeopathy at our next Questioning Science conference, which is in the summer.
Well, let's save that for a minute. We will. I'll get all that information off you now and shortly. We have 4 more questions for you. I'm going to have to quick fire these over to the two of you, and then we will get all your contact details and the courses you're doing. Don't worry, we'll get there. Right, Jimmy wants to know, Gloria, over to you. Question, have either guests heard of the study when babies are born that 98% are genius, and by the time they have been through the education system and die, it's down to 2%, a total reverse? Have you heard that?
I haven't, but I have heard Einstein's quote, that it's a miracle, this is what Einstein said, that curiosity survives the schooling system, which is actually a very similar idea. But we saw earlier, if you were able to listen earlier, I don't know, that actually some of the people who established what passes as the education system today had as their objective the dumbing down of people. I mean, I quoted Rockefeller, no less a person than Rockefeller, who said, I don't want a nation of thinkers, I want a nation of workers. Mm. So, of course, if you set out with an objective like that, you'll create the kind of education system we have, where, as you said, Alan, people are presented with facts and not always invited to question those facts. And I mentioned that I'd personally carried out a study looking at secondary school textbooks. And if I just quote from a GCSE science textbook, and GCSE is the examination currently done in schools in the UK by children who are 15 or 16 years of age. This is a widely used science textbook from 2016. And here's just two facts that they write about vaccination just a few years ago. The textbook says, it asserts, does not invite questioning. It says vaccinating people and animals against communicable disease means that they can't develop the infection and then pass it on to someone else. Well, we know there's evidence to contradict that,
yeah,
both in respect of some of the childhood vaccines, and also in respect of the jab program in the last 3 years. And then there's another section that states about epidemics. The textbook says that epidemics can be prevented if a large percentage of the population is vaccinated. Now, that statement ignores the natural immunity that humans have, and also the impact of vitamins and good diet on human health. So I just quote this as examples of what passes for education today. Yeah. As you said earlier, a lot of the time students are being presented with facts and not presented with contrary information that might contradict, which would allow us to debate. And there's only one other thing I wanted to say, that I don't think we should say that because some of these systems are not working today, for example, the university system seems to be in a very bad place. And I haven't talked today about the effects of peer review, for example, which is the system on which the whole edifice of universities depend, because academics' reputation relies on the number of peer-reviewed journal articles that they have. And there's no sour grapes on my part, because I have personally had about 70 or 80 peer-reviewed journal articles published, and I've been an editor on journals, so there's no sour grapes. But many people would say that the system of peer review is one that isn't working for advancement of knowledge. On the contrary, it's working to preserve in aspic, if you like, the knowledge as it is at a point in time. So I wouldn't want to say to people, don't go to university. Universities have no place. I think universities can have a tremendously important place. And I personally owe a great deal to my time, for example, at the London School of Economics, when I switched from a humanities background to a social science background. And I would say that I really learned to think quite clearly doing social sciences and learning to identify the factors. That was one of the favourite words that our lecturers used, the factors that determine what happens in a particular situation. So let us not assume that universities are not useful. I think they're tremendously useful in developing the mind, in developing good critical thinking practice. But there does need to be, I'm not sure the system can be reformed. I think very possibly we need to be, as with health and so many other areas, setting up new parallel structures.
Okay, no, that's fine. Now, I have, as I say, a few more questions. I'm just watching the time. We'll have to fly through these ladies as quick as we can. Catherine, what's your thoughts very quickly on the whole babies born 98% and by the time you get through the education system and you die, it's down to 2%. Quickly, what's your thoughts on that?
Yes, I would say Gloria's probably answered that comprehensively. And I haven't heard that before, but you know, I'm not. It would make sense to me, you know, completely. And there's a couple of educators who've written pieces in the book. Chad Mannion, who's an academic turned activist, and also Neil Ferguson, who writes about the lack of questioning of his students. He was a lecturer in mental health, and he just said he couldn't believe the woke culture of the students that didn't, for example, look into the money making gravy train of the pharmaceutical companies with regards to, let's say, antidepressants. So I think often the most sensitive good people are completely dumbed down. I mean, in my own case, I received when I was 21, electric shock therapy, and also was put onto mood stabilizing drugs, Pryadel, and lithium. And I was told that I'd be on that for the rest of my life. Now, along with what the question, I probably would have been pretty much a cabbage by now if I'd done that. I actually chose to think critically And I got a job as a textile designer in the Caribbean and played tennis and went swimming and had a good lifestyle. And as a result, I got myself better. So, and as a result of writing the book, other people have written in to me and said that they're, you know, they themselves or members of their family have suffered with bipolar and have been medicated and have had a really terrible life. There's an author, Philip Day, who's written a book which illustrates this called The Mind Game. So people who've been on heavy mental health medication, their lives can be absolutely ruined. So it wouldn't surprise me at all that a baby would start with 99% genius and end up with 2% at the end of a drugged and unhappy life.
Yeah, exactly. I'd agree with that. Okay, I'm only going to be able to fit one more question in, ladies. And the question I'm going to fit in is from Jimmy. And he says, question, do they find that those who critically think are more spiritually aware, perhaps they are reincarnates, perhaps more lives, more connected to the higher self, able to break the programming? Very quickly, Gloria, what do you think?
Well, if I refer to the contribution of Neil Cramer in the book, he suggests that there is evil in the world. He's a theologian, Neil Cramer, a British man who lives in America, and some of your viewers may know his work. And he says that, yes, but there is evil in the world, and it's there as a stimulus to how we respond to that evil. And some people will feel moved to take action against it, and maybe critical thinking is the prelude to taking action. And others, he said, will not be so minded. They will be much more likely to profit from the evil by working along the side of the system and benefiting from it. And so, yes, you could say from what Neil Cramer is saying that those who try to react against the evil in our world are perhaps more spiritually minded, more removed from ego, shall we say,
yeah,
than those who are content to live alongside the system.
Yeah,
I'm sure Catherine has thoughts on this.
Yes, I would agree. You know, he talks about the nature of our culture. You know, we have a lot of moral relativism now, and actually we need to discriminate and we need to really ask questions, and that comes from maybe as we discovered, Gloria, social science research, you know, those people who question have a high level of morality in their, that they recognize that a moral code is important.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I always say we go through three stages. We go from the matrix, and then we become aware, and then we become self-aware. And some people jump around, and they might go from the matrix, become self-aware, and not know about being aware of what's going on in the world. They become all spiritual, but you don't know why. Anyway, that's another show for another day. I think we'll have to do a part two, because I've more questions coming in and so much more to talk about, but we've reached that time, ladies. So a big, big thank you for coming on. And before I let you go, obviously now give out all your information you want to give out there about your shows and your books and everything else there.
Well, just to reiterate about Gloria's conferences, 16th to the 20th of August, up in the Peak District. We've got some great speakers, including the homeopath and scientist Trevor Gunn, who wrote Vaccination, a Point in Question, and he's going to be talking about natural immunity. And John Hamer, who did actually write a very good book on JFK called a Very British Coup, will be speaking. And he's written some other very good books. So if people are wanting to pursue their critical thinking journey, then that's a good one. Over to you, Gloria.
Yes. And John Hamer is tackling some very topical questions. He's going to be talking about the climate change hoax. He doesn't mince his words. And he'll be talking about the fake moon landings with very good evidence and a really interesting talk. He'll be talking about suppressed technologies. I can't wait for that talk. And then we've got Mark Devlin, who'll be talking on spiritual matters, actually, at this conference, on how forces beyond us can influence behaviour. And then there's myself. I'll be talking about the relationship between the ego and the collective, because many people these days would say that we need to be moving away from individualism and ego, on which individualism is based, to something that is more collective. And I'll be talking about some of the immense advantages that we could gain by shedding ego and moving to something more collectivist, but at the same time talking about some of the obstacles that stand in our way. And we've got another speaker who's talking about epigenetics and how we can alter the behavior of ourselves through the exercise of mental control.
Yeah.
And, oh gosh, then we've got another speaker talking about the biosphere and the energies that surround our body and how we can measure those and what we can learn from those energies. And we've got somebody talking about the anti-psychiatry movement. I mean, Catherine talked about the horrific side effects of certain drugs. Well, this will bring us up to speed on this growing movement within medicine called anti-psychiatry. People are asking, does the proliferation of diagnosed mental conditions, does it actually help us, or is it just there to provide a source of funding to Big Pharma? So there's a lot of stuff there. The conference lasts from Friday afternoon to Sunday afternoon, and some people like to come up a couple of days early. It's a beautiful venue, and it's a beautiful part of the world. And staying on a B&B breakfast, a bed and breakfast basis for the 2 days before the conference allows people to keep down their costs. And then we, as a group, if people want, we explore the Peak District this year. We'll be looking at the roots of the Industrial Revolution in the Peak District and applying our critical thinking to what we find there.
Brilliant stuff. Well, that's fantastic. Thank you, Gloria and Catherine, for coming on the show. I think we have a part two there because we didn't even touch base on ego. And ego was such a big thing these days with everything that's going on, and something that I touch base on as well in my seminar and the stuff I talk about. And, that's something else we're going to have to talk about. I think we're going to have to do a part two. I think that's going to be in the cards because we haven't even touched base on that. But a big thank you to both of you for coming on. Much, much appreciated. Just stay with me there for a minute. I'm just going to go off to a musical break and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Alan James on Circle of White Light Radio and People's Internet Radio.
Right, folks, sorry for we had to finish up. We just got beyond the time. I'm just watching the time there. So there's a couple of questions there in the chat room, but we definitely said we're going to do a part two. Gloria just wanted to mention again the book Critical Thinking, which is the book that she wrote, and you can get that from the info truth, or the email is, if you want to find out about her show that she's doing, you can go to email learningholidays@protonmail.com. And the book Critical Thinking, this can be bought from infotruthuniversity@protonmail.com. So if you want to buy the book, there you go. Now, the questions that we had left on the chat, Jimmy, do you find that those critical thinkers, okay, we've did that one. Joan, you had a question about Charlotte Thompson. Didn't get to that, I'm sorry. And you were talking about the George Orwell and the end of the book 1984. There was a piece that it never mentioned, which is about hope. Why? I wonder what your guests think. Well, I suppose it's got to do with hope, because maybe he did see some hope in people waking up before they actually got what they wanted. And that's what we're seeing now. we're seeing more and more people wake up and see what's going on. And as I said to Gloria and Catherine, when you show people the magic trick, no matter how many times the magician tries to fool you, if you know how it's done, then you won't be fooled. So the more we understand the techniques they use to try and fool us, like shutting down the prefrontal cortex and using fear, right, is one. The spin doctor stuff I told you about, the sleeve and the shirt, you know, that's all part of the PR spin. They use many tricks like that all the time. And once people are aware that they do that and why they do it, then you won't be fooled. So we need to have the critical thinking process in place. We need to be able to question and not just be given the one answer and accept that that's the answer. Because sometimes there's more than one answer. So again, entertain the thought without accepting it. Aristotle. Pop it on the shelf and go, okay, that's good. I got that answer. But is there another answer? You know, I mean, maybe I'm an IT guy. I was trained in IT and I've been in IT a long time. So I had to be a critical thinker because there's more than one way to skin a cat and more than one way to fix a problem. And I had to look at the problem and then try and come up with various different solutions and find which one's the best one to use. So I've been doing this critical thinking all my life. Really, since being, you know, working in computers. So I suppose to me it's second nature, but for other people it's not because they're not in that kind of area. But, you know, it doesn't take a genius to just ask a question and go, well, is there another solution to this or is there just only one solution? Or if somebody gives you a narrative, is there the other side of the narrative? Especially on narratives, there's always another side of to the narrative. And when people tell you about something or someone, you kind of go, don't just accept the information. Entertain it, obviously, but don't just accept it because that's the problem with, you know, and I know people will say, oh, that's not politically correct, but we use the word Chinese whispers all the time because we understand what it is. I did a psychological experiment when I was training on this and the psychologist lined up 10 people. And he whispered in the ear of the person down the end, and your woman, the man or girl, the girl or boy who he whispered to, then passed that information down to 10 people. By the time it got to the 10th person, it was different than what he gave at the start. And this is why, you know, when people tell you, I'll give you information, they will give you information based on what they've seen, what they've heard, their belief system, and so many different scenarios. And that's why when the police, you know, see a murder or an accident or something, they'll interview all the people around and they'll get the common denominator that runs through all them statements and go, well, okay, well, we know that happened because everybody agrees on that, but all the other fluff is probably just rubbish. So it's important that we have the ability to critically think, and that was the whole idea of getting Gloria and Catherine on the show tonight. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. Thanks to everybody in the chat room for your questions. Sorry we didn't get to all the questions there, but again, thanks for the questions anyway and putting them in. Right, next week I'm going to have an easy week next week because I'm going to do a pre-record of a show I did on video with Rachel Elnor. Not everybody has Rumble, I know, or is logged into Rumble. So I'll do the audio pre-record with Rachel Elnor on the show next week. It was a great interview. Had a great chat with her. Again, she's a corporate person, so we really kind of got into stuff. So I'll be doing that. And also what we have this week, apparently there's loads of talk about the energies and changes and everything else going on. We have the spring equinox, 21st, 22nd, which is happening this week. Loads of chat about it. So we'll just have to wait and see regarding the energies. Again, I will entertain information as always, but I can't believe it until it happens because I've heard it time and time again as to, oh, this is going to happen. It's coming soon. Here it comes. Here it comes. And it never does. It never does. So, again, I'll entertain it and it'll be interesting, but let's see what happens over the next week. Because by next week, we'll be coming to the end of the month. And they said that March is going to be a big one and a big shift and the portal opening and everything else. So loads of talk about it. So as I say, an open-minded skeptic as usual. Let's see what happens. So again, a big thank you to everybody for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed the show. Take care of yourself. Have a good week. Hope the weather's good for everybody. Stay safe. And if you have any information of interest, send it off to me and contact us at circlewhitelight.com. So take care and have a good one. Bye bye.
You have been listening to Circle of White Light Radio, focusing on solutions and thinking different.